Yeah, thank you. So Tommaso asked me to speak about constraints on dark matter cusps from baryons. So I have to apologize, I sort of random walked away from that topic. I'm not really going to talk much about cluster galaxies per se. I'm not going to talk about cusps per se. But I want to reassure you, I am talking. So what I'm going to focus on is actually some results we've gotten recently from our study of intracluster light. So these are stars that are distributed within sort of the cluster potential, perhaps associated with the central galaxy, perhaps not. That's more a topic of another talk. And what I'm showing you here is one example of the data that we have. This is a small part of an image surrounding this BCG, the brightest cluster galaxy, and this cluster. And sufficiently smooth and analyzing it in the proper way, you can actually detect that there's this intracluster light component. And although that's not the focus of this talk exclusively, it's sort of lessons learned from our study of the intracluster light, I just wanted to show you an example here. More of the focus, I think, is the interest that, and the interesting subject of baryonic processes and how those can affect our observations in clusters and in galaxies, and whether we can actually hope to put all the evil of the baryonic processes back in the Pandora's box. That is, we've now sort of unleashed gas physics, dissipation, feedback, and the whole box has come open now. And the question is whether this creates so much chaos that we're really now studying weather, or whether there's actually some hope that we can find some systematic trends in the data that can at least give us the hope that we'll be able to understand these processes. And this is work done with Anthony Gonzalez at Florida and Ann Zablagoff. So let's start off with clusters, which is, of course, the intracluster light results. But I will talk about galaxies later as well. So what can we say about baryons in clusters? So first, let's start with the distribution. Can we actually, do we even know what the distribution of baryons in clusters is? Have we accounted for all the baryons? That's sort of the first step to trying to see if we can explain how they're distributed in clusters. And what I plot here is the brightest cluster galaxy light plus the intracluster light. So I haven't tried to decouple the two components. I plot the combination of those two relative to all the light in galaxies. So this is just stellar baryons in clusters versus a radius as a fraction of R200 here, going from 0.1 R200 to the R200. And if you follow, if you just look at the solid symbol, the solid sort of octagons, I guess, if you follow those, what you're seeing is that the light in this intracluster component goes from about 60% of all the starlight at a tenth of the virial radius to about 25% or so enclosed at R200. So that's telling you right there that even stellar baryons, whether they're in this sort of intracluster component or whether they're in galaxies, distributed differently in the cluster. So you have to be careful when you say baryons are distributed in a particular way, because the different components are distributed differently. Now that result's been known. For example, the work of Zebedi et al. Showed that in fact the intracluster light is more tightly distributed around the cluster core than the galaxies. But one interesting thing, what we found is that if you break up our sample into high mass and low mass clusters, the high mass clusters have lower intracluster light fractions. The low mass clusters have higher intracluster light fractions, which might naively be different than what your expectation would be, where you'd think there'd be more tidal stripping in a massive cluster, more intracluster light. In fact, it doesn't work out that way. And so when you're talking about baryons, and now this is just stellar baryons, not only do you have to worry about the radial distribution, but you have to worry about what type of system you're talking about. It's not just clusters have blank fraction of intracluster light. It does depend on mass. The mass to light ratio of the two components are pretty similar. The ICL light is old light, and the galaxies are mostly old ellipticals. I mean, there's a mixture, but so it's not a big fraction change. All right, so this is the radial plot just again, just the stars. Let's take a look and see if we can understand the entire distribution of the baryons in these clusters. So focusing on these two panels first, what I plot is log of the mass fraction. So this is, this panel shows the stars, that's a function of mass. This is all done to R500. Unfortunately don't have the measurements out to R200 for all these components. So out to R500, log mass fraction for the stars, for the gas. The gas is done from recent measurements presented by Viklinen et al. From Chandra, so that's these points here. And the dotted line here is sort of the universal value from WMAP, the third-year analysis. So if any component had all of the baryons, they would be at the red line. Okay. So you can see by the time you're talking systems of a 7, 8 × 10^13 solar masses, you're getting close to stars having almost all the baryons. Whereas if you're talking about systems at around 10^15 solar masses, you're getting close to all the baryons being in the hot phase in the plasma. But there is this interesting trade-off between the two components where you're seeing that the baryons match each other, and I'll show you why I say that they match each other, in the sense that the gas turns, if there's a deficit of gas, it turns into the stars. You can see that up here in this panel where I now just plot mass fraction. So this is omega B over omega M, basically. The red rectangle here represents the WMAP measurements, so the universal value. The line is the sum of these two components. You see it's pretty flat, and the hashed region is sort of our uncertainty given what slopes you could fit here. So there are a few things to take away from this, is that we do have a reasonable accounting of the baryons in these systems. There might be another component that pushes this up a little bit, but it's not going to be a gross change. And that, again, this trade-off between plasma and stars. Now, why is this interesting in the context that we've been talking about? Well, the plasma, the hot gas, is actually thought to be more distributed radially, but farther spread out than the dark matter. So in fact, we've been talking about, baryons get packed into the centers and therefore change the profile one way. In fact, the hot gas, isn't doing that. So if in fact a cluster was entirely this hot plasma, you wouldn't have this extra concentration of baryons in the center. Whereas by the time you get to these systems, you're now talking about stars, and the stars certainly are more concentrated toward the center than the dark matter. And then, of course, even in the stars, there are these two components, where there are the galaxies, which are somewhat more concentrated than the dark matter, and the intercluster stars, which are even more concentrated towards the center. So if you're trying to understand processes that move baryons around, you really have to do the full accounting for all these various components. So that's sort of one lesson that we've gotten from including the intercluster light into the accounting. I've talked about clusters. Let me now move more to sort of broader scales, try to incorporate a wider range of systems and see if in fact patterns like this or other patterns become more evident. Now, let's move to galaxies. And so we've already heard a little bit about it this morning, about the fundamental plane. Now, the fundamental plane provides information in that it tells us something about the packing of baryons in dark matter halos. You could imagine a wide range of ways of packing baryons into dark matter halos that would give you different effective radii, different central means surface brightnesses within RE. Theoretically, you could do that any way you want to. The fundamental plane is telling us that, in fact, nature does it a particular way. Now, we heard a little bit about the use of the word fundamental and whether that really implies some deep physics or is a rather cavalier use of the word fundamental. I'll leave that to your discretion, and of course you're free to refer to this talk as the fundamental talk. Now these are ellipticals. This is a sample from Jurgsen et al. And it shows you, very nice correlation here. Low scatter, which is of course the hallmark of the fundamental plane. And what you're plotting here is RE versus a combination of of sigma, the velocity of dispersion, and this mean surface brightness within RE. And so the question is, you know, how did this get set up? Is this telling us something deep about this packing of baryons and dark matter halos? How does this this set of objects relate to objects that are both bigger and smaller? If we can probe a large dynamic range in this, perhaps we can get a handle on the baryonic processes that lead to something like this. So let's look a little bit about at the background of the fundamental plane, or at least it's, you know, it's back of the envelope derivation that people use. So it starts off with the virial theorem, which I think we can all accept. And after that, it becomes a little bit more and more, shall we say, you know, loose. First you turn the kinetic energy into, you know, you V squared, m, you know, 1/2 V squared m. You move the m's around. You say that the potential is some scaling of gm over r. Then you, how do you get m? Well, you use the mass to light ratio. You use the light, this. So that gives you some estimate of the mass. Anyway, you could question any of these steps, and you'd be right to question them. But you can take log of this expression, rearrange the terms, and you get an expression that relates RE to sigma to surface brightness with this M over L term. And if you said, well, this doesn't include feedback or star formation or outflow or inflow, you'd be right. All of that is in some magical way perhaps included in M over L, but it's not clear that that would, you know, that a simple expression for M over L would work. So here you have, you notice that this is not 2, this is not minus 1, and so this is called the tilt of the fundamental plane and is ascribed to some behavior of M over L to these quantities, okay, in a very simple way. So for example, I think Paul showed a scaling with IE to some power. If you put IE to some power here, the power would come out and you would change the coefficient of that term. Now let's look at other populations. Here now I've added a sample from Lauer that includes a lot of BCGs. And you start perhaps seeing some deviation from the line. Perhaps you wouldn't worry about it. You'd say photometry is different in some way. Now I've added the intracluster light. So I'm treating the cluster as a gigantic spheroid. I'm using the velocity dispersion of the cluster, but I'm using the photometric properties of the intracluster light. And you start seeing a strong deviation from the fundamental plane description. This is actually, I believe, with the central galaxy. But we've done it various ways, and it doesn't qualitatively affect the result. This is now going to lower mass systems. So these are mainly DEs from Virgo and Coma. And perhaps, maybe, there's some deviation there. And this is now adding local group systems. So dwarf spheroidals, the dwarf ellipticals in Andromeda. And, well, no, it's no longer a nice, simple relationship here. So the fundamental plane does not appear to describe the whole family of spheroids. So you can either say that there are different classes of objects. You know, what in the world are you doing putting dwarf spheroidals in with, you know, clusters? Reasonable. I mean, they have very different objects. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is that the fundamental relationship is somewhat more complex. That this M over L term is not just a simple power law scaling, which would simply just modify the coefficients, but it's something more involved. So let's look a little bit at that. This is the relationship I will eventually get, okay? And I will now describe how I get it. I don't give you the axes yet, but it includes all the dwarf spheroidals. This is actually M32 down here. In here are some minor Draco and so forth, and this is our most massive cluster. I haven't deleted anything from the sample. This is how we get it. So if you look at mass to light, now this is a sort of hokey mass to light ratio. This is sort of a unit analysis mass to light ratio for these systems. But if you look at what you estimate for the mass to light ratio inside RE, this, against sigma, or log sigma, you get this parabolic shape, which you may remember something similar to that for global mass to light ratios, I think from James's talk earlier. Okay? And this is just a parabola. Now, just to highlight where various types of systems are, these were the BCGs. Here are the ICL cluster from the clusters that we added. These are the dwarf spheroidals. So let's say you say clusters don't really belong in this, dwarf spheroidals, you know, don't try to put those on this relationship. I think you'd still get curvature in this relationship even from just the giant ellipticals to normal ellipticals to DEs. So I think you would fit a very similar, if you wanted to fit a parabola to these data, I think you would get a very similar thing. If you take that parabola now, that expression for M over L is function of sigma, plug back into the back of the envelope expression for the fundamental plane, that's where you get this. So now, you know, this sigma term is a little more complicated because of this inclusion of this parabolic behavior in mass-to-light ratio instead of some power law behavior in mass-to-light ratio. But it now explains every type of spheroid we can find in the universe. So, you know, to me, this signifies some hope that this is a single family of spheroids, that all these baryonic processes that we worry about, they may all exist, but they behave in ways that are not, you know, abnormal, psychotic, and drive many different types of behavior. That smoothly they transform from one to the other in such a way that you preserve this type of relationship over four orders of scale in RE. And while I'm not here to present an answer, sort of similar to Pandora's myth, I hope there's hope out there. And hope is a two-edged sword. It can lead, you know, to a lot more work to try to explain this. But I think that this is showing us that, in fact, the baryonic processes, that we can get some simple descriptions of what's going on. Just to close, the scatter here is a little bit larger than in the original fundamental plane. It's about 0.15 in magnitudes. Fundamental plane scatters typically, in good fundamental planes, are 0.08, 0.09 magnitudes. So the scatter is larger, but I've done this by cobbling together many different sets of data with different photometry that I've had to, you know, put in different color terms and so forth. So I suspect that the scatter in this relationship is actually significantly smaller than the 0.15, which again suggests that, you know, if there's blowout in galaxies, it doesn't happen in this galaxy and not in that galaxy, sort of thing. And so I'll leave it there and I'll take questions. Thank you.
So who has a fundamental problem to raise?
Where's the other microphone?
There's one here. It's not on, I think.
Hello. Okay. I have a very simple question, which is what band is all this in, and would it make a difference if you change the band?
So this is all so the ICL data is taken in I band, and then most of the other systems had to be transformed to I. So yes, there would be some changes. You know, these coefficients might change slightly in the different bands. I haven't done the exercise of transforming to other bands because I don't really ascribe any deep physical significance to 3.7, for example. But if you think you do, then yes, you know you probably want to do this at K band or something. But, yeah.
Hi, Dennis. In disk galaxies, you see something, a sort of a similar effect with the mass-to-light ratio flaring up, and that seems to depend on the surface density. And I wonder if that, I mean, the dwarf spheroidals are certainly low-density systems, and maybe, in effect, the ICL is too. So I wonder if you could check that and see if that's an effect that goes in that same direction.
Yeah, so I suggest, Stacy, that if you continue asking questions, you sit somewhere else. But but let me answer your question. So I did try, first sort of a variation with IE. So M over L, some function of IE. That doesn't work as well. It helps, but it doesn't produce as low a scatter in this as sigma does, apparently. But it's, you know, it's not unique. It could be, you know, we didn't want to get finesse the problem too much, but you could imagine that it's, you know, sigma IE is really what plays into this and not just sigma. But sigma alone works better than IE alone. That's I can say that much.
Leo Koppels. Your master light ratio seems to minimize more or less around L star galaxies. I mean, what is special about these objects that master light ratio minimizes roughly there? I mean, do you have any physical process that explains?
No, I don't really have any physical processes. I mean, we can imagine that as you go to bigger scales, these things are more dissipationless mergers, and so that they do not concentrate the baryons anymore. And that as you go to these systems, you start getting all the effects people talk about, but sort of spread out baryons, feedback, whatever. But no, we looked, one thing we tried to do is see whether this minimum occurred sort of at this magic mass of, you know, 3×10^10, you know, stellar mass. It doesn't, but the minimum's not very well constrained. So, and because of the, you know, we have different samples sort of pulling on this, so I could imagine that if the photometry is a little bit off, then in the comparison of the DEs to the Es, it would skew things around. So I don't ascribe too much physical significance yet to our fit for this minimum mass, but it may be that it ties into what other people.
So, sorry.
Oh yes, no. So this value is okay. This value I don't understand.
So, exactly. Just to continue. I mean, if you apply now this mass light ratio correction to, let's say, a luminosity function, would you straighten out the luminosity function? If you do it not in numbers, but in luminosity?
I haven't done that. Now, this is really the mass to light ratio inside of RE. So how this, you would like to have the version of this for global, but this isn't it. But, you know, a first step would be to just try this and see if indeed this somehow maps onto the global relationship and whether this helps. But I haven't done that. I remember 60-ish, it's in the paper, but I don't remember the number. No, it's not really L-star. I mean, L-star is probably about here.
One question that I have is that here you're using the velocity dispersion, but my feeling is that the velocity dispersion means different things for the different system that you have plotted there. For example, for the fundamental plane, we are talking about systems that are virialized. When you're talking about the intracluster light or even the L of the CDEs, we know that there is a substantial substructure there. So sigma means different things in different parts of the diagram. The other thing is, while RE is well defined for the vacuolar law because the profile integrates to a total luminosity, when you are in cluster, what it is, RE, and especially for the dwarf, if you have an exponential profile, what it is the RE.
Right. So, yes, so both points are well taken. On the sigmas, there's actually even more than that in the sense that the sigma, at least in the elliptical studies, are usually sigma within RE. And we've taken, you know, sigmas from all over the place here. So again, you know, that's not satisfactory. I can't imagine a way, though, that leads to, you know, the relationship. So I could imagine adding scatter, you know, having, you know, problems in putting things on the same system by having different sigmas. But I can't imagine why you would get it to create this relationship. Now, while we started, you know, we started sort of from the ICL because that's what we were doing, and there are, you know, definitely questions about what is the proper velocity dispersion measurement to take for the ICL. We've just used the galaxies. These are relaxed systems. You know, people have for a long time been using the velocity dispersion in these clusters as, you know, relaxed systems to measure the mass. So, you know, in that sort of tradition, we've done the same thing. But again, you know, they could have substructure. The velocity dispersions might be, you know, over or underestimated for on an individual system basis. But again, it doesn't seem to create. I can't see a way that this creates this relationship. But even if you exclude this, now once we've added all these other systems, I think even if you excluded this, and if you just, you know, took away this last order of magnitude, it's still, you know, still a relationship that extends quite a bit. So I agree with the principle of the objection. I just don't see a way that this twists the result. Now, as far as RE, what we've actually done is a half light radius for the clusters and everything, and the dwarf spheroidals as well. So we, you know, you can't fit an exponential profile to everything, so we've taken the half light radius. I've written it as RE. I've glossed over a lot of details in this. Again, there are certainly difficulties in putting all these things on the same system in a coherent way that you really like to do it. But that would just seem to increase the scatter and ruin this thing rather than creating it. Maybe not.
James, and then we have to move on, I think.
So for the your result on ICL fraction as a function of cluster mass, do you have a sense of, is that just driven by what's going on with the central galaxy, or is that, can you differentiate the two?
Yeah, so for any specific system, it can be hard to break the ICL and the BCG component apart. There's a subset of systems for which there's actually a position angle and ellipticity twist, in which case you have a little more confidence in how you're breaking the two systems up. In our sample, typically, the ICL is about 80% of the total light of BCG plus ICL. So the ICL really dominates the light, typically. But it's not every system that does that. But so generally, our BCG plus ICL results really represent the ICL.
And that doesn't change the function of
the cluster. When we've looked, there's a lot of scatter. So I can say that there's no trend. If you wanted to fit something to it, it, you know, it might be consistent as well with no trend. But there's certainly no trend.
Let's thank Dennis again. Thank Dennis again. And we move on to David Sand, who will give the lens